Recorded live in downtown Newtown and points elsewhere, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. Welcome everybody listening in to Season 1, Episode number 14 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slevin, and I'm alone in the studio this morning, once again staring out at a crisp spring Wellington morning. Kaylee Carruthers, you are in an as yet undisclosed location. Where are you this week?
Yes, this week I am in the very rainy suburb of Maple Ridge, just outside of Vancouver, British Columbia.
And do you have a view where you are?
I can sort of see out the window. It's grey skies. There's a front that's been moving through. That was supposed to end yesterday. So.
And you're currently hiding from a toddler, I understand. So perhaps your position under the bed or in the wardrobe would prevent a view.
A little bit, yeah. So you might hear her in the background just knocking on the door, asking where Kiki is. So.
And you are going to be a dutiful aunt and ignore her for the next hour or so. Well done.
I'm a terrible person.
On today's program, award-winning Scottish actor Peter Mullen is in Auckland to give a masterclass at the Big Screen Symposium. I caught up with him yesterday for a chat about his career as an actor, writer and director. Another director, Jonathan King, has just been to Austin to show his new film Reality at Fantastic Fest, and he'll tell us what that was like and what else he got up to during that five-day movie lovers party. Kaylee's going to update us about her North American odyssey, I hope, and we will also review Tom Hardy in Locke and Irfan Khan in The Lunchbox, all of that, as you probably guessed, plus the usual glut of news, stats and opinion. Kaylee, do you have the mailbag handy?
Yes. Well, the other day, because I'm in Vancouver and the Vancouver International Film Festival, I believe, is now underway or just about to get underway, I asked for suggestions from our lovely Twitter people, asking anything that they would like to hear about, because yes, I'm a little bit lazy and I can't make decisions. But also, I am at this festival. If there is anything you guys would like me to see or you want to hear about or get more information, let me know, and I'd be happy to go. I won't be going to anything this week because I am out in the suburbs helping my brother and sister-in-law move into town, but I'll be back in the city in October, so I'll be able to catch the entire second week of the festival. So Dilla Monster, also known as Doug Dilliman, jumped on right away and said, "Heaps, Phoenix, Two Shots Fired, Hey Moo, Ow, The Iron Ministry, The Midnight After, Tadas, Do It All, House, and Run, along with the international theatrical cut of Hope and Wire," which you're surprised to discover exists. So
that was a very fast response and an incredibly thorough response from somebody who's supposed to be finishing their novel, to just point out. Anyway, yep. We'll tease Doug about his novel until it emerges.
Yes. The Mirka tweeted, "Hoped that Magic in the Moonlight would strike gold, but my two-word review is lesser Woody."
Mm. Mm, yeah, good. Anything from Fred Thompson this week?
Yeah, there is. There is. I'm getting to it. Getting to it. I just want to highlight our other Twitter fans out there, you know, everyone gets a slice of the pie this week.
Yeah.
Reese Pie tweeted or retweeted and tagged us in Making Ofs, a geographical look at how many people Liam Neeson has killed in his movies and where, which is a lovely little image of us.
And on the subject of Liam Neeson, the confirmation that the third Taken film is going to be called TAK3N, or Taken with a 3 in the E. Yeah, even though apparently no one's going to be taken in this film. So, you know,
Wow.
Maybe that's all I know.
Takeaways.
Oh, and also another Liam Neeson news. Apparently he's also going to be in Ted 2.
Oh, right. Wonderful. Hmm. And of course, Fred Thompson, who sends us at least 2 2-word reviews per week, which we do love. So the first one is The Giver. His 2-word review is dull and generic, clunky expository dialogue, rushed and confusing narrative. Seen it before, only better. I have to agree with that.
Yep. And if you wanted our version of that at probably considerably greater length, you can also listen to last week's show.
Yes, you can. And 2-word review for Men, Women, and Children, voyeuristic snapshot. Somber and depressing, but ensemble cast were excellent, especially Sandler.
What?
I'm reading. That's what I'm reading.
Hard to believe. But anyway, there you go. And so is that us? Are we on to box office now?
I think that's a pretty good collection.
A pretty good summary of what's been in the mailbag during the last week. So what have people been going to see this week? Let's have a look at New Zealand first, Kaylee.
Yes, in number 5, The 100, which is down from 4, The 100-Foot Journey. In at number 4, down from 3, Guardians of the Galaxy. In number 3, down from 2, Lucy. In the number 2 spot, bumped out of the first spot, Into the Storm. And in the number 1 spot, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. In previews.
In previews, no, I think it actually opened last week. No, you're right. It still says previews. I shows you how much attention I'm paying in Mutant Ninja Turtles land. Yes. Australia now. Let's have a quick look there. 5, Step Up, all in, down from 2. Planes, Fire and Rescue, straight in at number 4. We get that. I think that's open this weekend here because school holidays start on Monday here in New Zealand. At number 3, also, school holiday fodder, The Box Trolls is straight in there in Australia. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles being held from the top spot in Australia by The Maze Runner, straight in at number 1 on $5.6 million Australian dollars.
In the US box office, in at number 5, Dolphin Tale 2. Number 4, No Good Deed. Number 3, This Is Where I Leave You. Number 2, A Walk Among the Tombstones. And number 1, The Maze Runner. And the top 3, it is all their first week in release. So there you go.
And in the UK last weekend, number 5, The Riot Club. Number 4, Lucy, still hanging in there. Number 3, Pride, which had its media screenings here in New Zealand last night. And I heard some very, very wonderful things from people who were there at the screening in Auckland. So looking forward to that. Number 2 in the UK, A Walk Among the Tombstones. And it slipped my mind what that film is about. Has anybody got any ideas?
No.
Nope. Okay. We really need to do just a teeny weeny bit more research, don't we? And number 1 in the UK, in my defence, it is 7:20 on a Friday morning. Number 1 in the UK, The Box Trolls.
And I've heard good things about The Box Trolls.
I have too. And again, sort of landing here in New Zealand very soon. Do you have any sense of what people are going to see in Canada?
No, not really.
In the suburbs? In the burbs? Where's your nearest picture theatre from where you are?
It's probably about a 5 or 10 minute drive. It's a big multiplex, as is the fashion here in North America, and that's where I saw Guardians of the Galaxy, actually, nearest cinema.
Yes,
but once we move back into the Vancouver, my nearest cinema will be the famous Rio Theatre on Commercial Drive, so it'll be great to go catch some films there, especially their midnight screenings, which are pretty exciting. And they were also one of the first cinemas to get a license to serve alcohol in the theatre.
That is a claim to fame. I remember you telling us about in the past. It's obviously extremely important to you, that particular fact. All right, onto the main part of the show, or at least one of the main features of the show. Now, Peter Mullen is an actor who will be well known to many of you. If you don't know his name, you'll recognise his face. He was in Shallow Grave, Trainspotting, Braveheart. He's won the Best Actor Award at the 1998 Cannes Film Festival for My Name is Joe, Ken Loach's film. He's worked for Alfonso Cuarón in Children of Men. He was in Boy A. And he's also a writer and director himself. The Magdalene Sisters was one of his film, and a film a couple of years ago called Neds, which played at the International Film Festival. So Peter Mullen, probably best known most recently in New Zealand for a leading role in Jane Campion's Top of the Lake, which was shot in Queenstown and surrounds a couple of years ago. And this year he was also one of the lead actors in Sunshine on Leith, the adaptation of the musical about the Proclaimers music. So basically one of the most successful and interesting actors around. He's in Auckland at the moment preparing to present masterclasses and Q&As at the annual Big Screen Symposium, which is a gathering of New Zealand filmmaking talent for a weekend to talk about storytelling, talk about industry issues, and just generally try and get everybody talking to each other. It's a fantastic event. So Peter Mullen's here for that, and he very graciously gave me a couple of minutes, 20 probably more like, to talk to him yesterday morning. Peter Mullen, thanks very much for visiting with us here at Rancho Notorious.
Thank you very much. Good to be talking to you.
You're here for the Big Screen Symposium in Auckland this weekend. It's a very grand title for quite a relaxed and informal sort of series of sessions. What are you going to be doing here at the symposium?
There's a couple of things. I'm doing what they call a masterclass. It's a very grand title for just, you know, someone to stand there and just chat about the work. And then on the, I think it's the Sunday, there's a In Conversation With type of thing whereby I'm asking, you know, but again, chatting about the work from a slightly different perspective. But for the masterclass, it's primarily just, it's a question and answer session. So it's about acting, writing and directing. And whatever the folk want to know, I can tailor the discussion to what it is they want to know about.
And obviously there's a lot to be gained in terms of the people coming to watch and listen to you. There's a huge amount for them to gain. But what are you hoping to get out of the experience? Are you going to looking to sort of check out some of the other sessions as well?
Yeah, well, definitely as many as I can. What I really enjoy about these types of things is that, you know, just by meeting fellow kind of filmmakers and people who are interested in film, that basic interaction can often bear fruit in a whole multitude of different ways, you know, because it hopefully in these things, if the chemistry's right, these things oftentimes they produce the unexpected in yourself and hopefully in the people that attend the session, because you go in there with a certain set of ideas, I guess, and then through that kind of interaction, then you know, something else kind of comes out of it.
There's something about the importance of the Big Screen Symposium and that event here in New Zealand, because in terms of helping New Zealand independent filmmakers get their work up and help continue the process of developing a New Zealand voice on screen. Is that something that you feel is important in the Scottish context? Like, is there still an strenuous efforts to preserve and to develop a Scottish voice on screen?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, not just Scotland, but Ireland, Wales, even England. There's always any country on earth when it comes to cinema. It's within the realms of independent cinema that the real voices are heard, because the demands of commercial cinemas are so completely different that the true sense of any culture is often lost, because of the so-called commercial demands and the size of budgets and what they regard as being international and all that sort of stuff. And effectively what then happens is there's a dilution of what would have been the original idea behind a work. So regardless of where you are, and obviously that includes American filmmakers also, it's by the very nature of independent cinema, is that if it's independent both of mind and spirit, then you can achieve something. I mean, there's a downside to independent cinema in the sense that there are some, by virtue of it being low budget, would maintain that it's of that spirit, when oftentimes it's basically just a calling card for commercials to do a commercial piece of work. And there's nothing in and of itself wrong with that, but it's not really the type of cinema that I'm really interested in. I'm more interested in filmmakers who really do have something to say. And the more specific it is oftentimes to their own culture, the more universal it naturally becomes.
The films that you've made as a director, they very much fit that bill in terms of something to say. Who are the filmmakers that you've worked with that that informed your work as a writer and director, or inspired you?
There's been a whole host, if I'm being honest, in terms of the directors I've worked with, and it would range from, you know, Ken Loach, Danny Boyle, Jane Campion, right to the other end of the spectrum, which would be Mel Gibson, Steven Spielberg. You know, the greatest directors that I've worked with, none of them have anything particularly in common, other than the fact that they have their own point of view, their own perspective. They're not a director for hire, you know. They actually do have a vision, if you like, and they bring their own personalities on set. And all of them have completely different working methods, and in most cases, they're completely different filmmakers. But if they have anything in common, it's that they are what we tend to refer to as grown up, and I don't mean that in any age sense. You often refer to a good director as he's a grown up or she's a grown up, meaning that there's no posturing on a set. It's that they're alive to all the possibilities of working with director of photography and everyone else involved in the crew, but possibly most vitally the way in which they work with actors. And like I say, everyone's got a different working method completely. But in essence, it's that they're open to ideas and suggestions and just trying things out. And that has an enormous impact on particularly actors, because you feel that even if a film doesn't in and of itself work, you do feel that you're in safe hands, as it were. That at least you're working with someone and not for someone.
That was a question that I was going to ask you a little bit later on, but I'll jump ahead to it. You're talking about collaboration and those directors who are interested in what you want to bring. As a writer director yourself, do you relish being on those sorts of sets where you're being treated as a full creative collaborator like that?
You mean when it's a film I'm directing?
Yeah, or when you're working as an actor, what sort of pleasure do you get from that collaborative process?
First of all, on a purely basic level, it's great to not have to be directing. It's good just being an actor, because there's an awful lot more fun to acting, if I'm being honest. Directing is deeply satisfying in an altogether different way, but in a purely childish, frivolous kind of way, acting is more fun, I guess. What I get from it is like anything, you feel free to just to try things out, and you're not going to be denigrated or humiliated or shouted at or whatever, which should never happen to anyone in any line of work. But at the core of every actor, there's a terrified person who kind of ultimately wants to please, and if directors like to show their displeasure you know, aberrant behaviour, and it can make for a pretty miserable experience. I've never personally experienced it, if I'm being honest. I wouldn't tolerate it, if I'm being absolutely honest. But I know way too many actors who have been subjected to that type of thing, and it's a horrible experience. So when you're actually working with someone who basically is curious and in many ways as nervous as you are, and we all get nervous on a film set, but what diminishes the nerves and extinguishes the nerves is when you come up with something half decent, you know, or better still, if you come up with something really good. You everybody, and as everybody on the set, gets a real buzz out of that. And by really good, obviously that's a very subjective kind of term, but normally that is when something happens that nobody, including the actor, writer, director, crew, or anyone, expected. You know, that the alchemy actually produces something that has grown completely out of that collaboration.
The films that you have written and directed, you said just a little bit earlier on that it's a lot easier to just turn up and act. Is that is the fact that they're so draining and so demanding one of the reasons why they're so infrequent on your CV, or is it just the nature of getting projects up these days?
It's a strange one, actually. I'd never intended only to make, I've only made 3 feature films in whatever it is, 14 years, and it was never intentional. It's not a case I've got all these projects which are undeveloped, which happens to a lot of writer directors. It's more the case that acting work comes in, and I need to pay the bills. It's just kind of simple as that. And like, there's one project I've got on the go. It's now nearly 2 years old. When I wrote it, and it's been, you know, we're still, you know, in process of getting the finance for that. So yeah, financing a film can take a long time. But in the meantime, all this, you know, cool kind of acting work comes up, and in order to pay the rent, then you have to do it. And for other directors, I know that's not the case. For other writer directors who are, you know, richer than I am, it's more a case of they've often struggled to get the productions off the ground. But it's not because of the exhaustion. Directing a film is just, I love it, if I'm being honest. Not as much as I love acting, as I say, because that's a more selfish, frivolous kind of activity, really. But directing was, I would gladly have done more, and we'll probably hopefully do more. But where it is, it's lifelong, more than acting, I have to confess. It stays with you much longer, and because it's your baby and you're responsible for it. And once you've finished it and it goes out there, you know, you hope you're going to get a good response. And then the actual travelling with the film, particularly independent film, can take anything up to a year. Because, you know, you're going to all the different countries, all the different festivals, in the hope that, you know, people will see it. And you kind of, you go along with it in a way that in commercial cinema, you don't need to do as much. In that respect, you can finish a project and then move on to the next one. Mm. Whereas in independent cinema, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah, they're like rock tours, aren't they?
Sorry, mate?
They're like rock tours, aren't they?
You know, yeah, basically. And, you know, and you need to sell it more. I don't mean that in the commercial sense. I just mean that in the sense that to try and get an audience for it. Mm. So that's been my difficulty, in the sense that in between acting jobs, it's oftentimes difficult to just sit down and write something. Mm. I mean, I'm a terrible prevaricator. You know, I mean, that's why when I normally let an idea sort of develop, if you like, in my head for quite a long time. When I actually sit down finally and start writing, I tend to write really quick, you know, as in a matter of weeks. And that's kind of the way I like to do it.
I was going to ask
other writers are far more disciplined.
Sure. I was going to ask you whether you are one of those actors who sits in the trailer in those long periods of time between takes, typing away on a laptop, whether you like to be sort of out and about on the set when you're not required, sort of soaking up the atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm the latter. I like to be out and about and on the set. I've tried a million times to sit in a trailer if you're lucky enough to have one. Actually, I don't even mean that. I don't like trailers very much. I've tried it. It doesn't work for me. I can't completely separate myself from a set and in my head go off to another work that you're working on. And that's not, it's not because I'm a method actor or I have to be in. In fact, quite the opposite. I really enjoy film sets. They're great fun. I mean, it's brilliant meeting all these new people and soaking up the atmosphere, exchanging anecdotes and stories and jokes and laughing about. I love that aspect of filmmaking. It's, when you're actually on a film set, I have to say it's the greatest job in the world. There's no doubt about it, because you know you're free to explore things and very few people are fortunate enough to do.
And you get to see different parts of the world as well. We here at Rancho Notorious are big fans of Dwayne Johnson, and we really enjoyed Hercules, and your presence did a lot to elevate that picture as well. I mean, what was that that like? That was a relatively big budget movie, but shot in Eastern Europe, I think.
Yeah, it was shot in Budapest. It's a wonderful town, very beautiful. I'd been there before the wall came down. I was there in 1989, when it was under the Soviet Union at the time. And it's changed dramatically, for the better, ultimately, but there's other parts not so good. But lovely town, and the actual experience of the production was just with the actors and stuff. We just had a great time. You know, it was great fun, because you know you're hanging out with lovely John Hurt and Rufus Sewell and Ian McShane and Rebecca Ferguson and like a whole host of really, and Axel and Reese and a whole host of really, really, really lovely actors. And Big Dwayne.
Yeah.
Big Dwayne's an absolute, he's a sweetheart. He's a total delight. He's a lovely, lovely gentleman. He was, every time he came on set, you know, he's the way it should be. You know, he's very polite, very caring towards other members of cast and crew. And that's really important, you know, because obviously the movie's built around Dwayne. You know, he's Hercules and the big superstar and all that sort of stuff. And he didn't bring any of that silly nonsense on set. You know, the nonsense being that I'm a movie star and you've all got to get down on your knees and, you know, worship. He appreciated the fact he was working with, you know, some really good actors, and he enjoyed it, you know, and it's reciprocated. So, no, it was a lovely, lovely atmosphere amongst the actors and stuff. We had a great time.
Dwayne Johnson, we here in New Zealand like to claim a little piece of, because he actually went to Richmond Road Primary School, not very far away from where you are at the moment. An experience like that, and then going to New Zealand to work with Jane Campion on Top of the Lake. Can you tell us a little bit about what attracted you to that role? Because on the surface, it seemed to me that role was not going to be a huge change of direction for you. But was it working with Jane? Was it coming here? What was the reasoning behind that?
It was the script, you know, and Jane. I mean, the way I always try to work is, if you're lucky enough to be looked at for a part, is, you know, do you go on with the director? But that has to come in conjunction with the script. And I read the script and loved it. It was very reminiscent of TV shows that I loved, like, you know, Twin Peaks, obviously, and that's slightly David Lynchian. I loved the boldness of it and the risks it was taken. And then I met Jane in London, and we talked about the character and all that kind of stuff. And then I was lucky enough to get offered it. So it was a kind of no brainer. Really, because if you get a script that's that interesting and that good, it never bothers me what size a part is or if a part's in the same territory as I've done before, because every soul's different, And that's all as an actor you can do. I mean, I've never thought of myself as a career actor. I don't sort of walk around thinking, oh, you know, I must do a comedy next, or, you know, I really must get down to London and do some Shakespeare, you know, for the sake of career. Mm. I'm not built that way. I mean, acting to me is, I'm primarily, ironically, given that I've only made three, I've always thought of myself more as a writer-director, and acting's the fun part. I mean, I do take it seriously insofar as, you know, I've worked a lot in it and got an awful lot out of it. I don't take it seriously. I think that's a big, big, big mistake for an actor to make, because it's essential that you see the ultimately kind of childlike origins of it, and you have to appreciate that we're not prophets, we're not, you know, people that are, you know, somehow greater than any other human being on the earth. In fact, it's quite the opposite. You know, I mean, Tom Stoppard, I remember reading somewhere, talked about, well, it was only 400 years ago when actors were nailed to the ground outside every village to warn other actors not to go near the village. And then in the course of the 20th century, and with the coming of cinema and then television, they've been elevated to an absolutely absurd kind of status, in every way, in terms of supposed influence and the salaries they can command. And personally, best of luck, if they can get a great salary, good for them. But it's one thing for society to elevate actors to that level. It's another thing for actors to start elevating themselves to that level. And that's when it just gets silly, beyond belief, and offensive in many respects. Or it can be, depending on how the actor behaves. I think it's vital that when you're in that arena, if you want to call it that, which is, you know, basically part of the circus, is that by maintaining a healthy kind of scepticism about it, you not only keep your own kind of sanity, but you can bring that to whatever part you're playing. So for someone like and the character, I'm sorry, I forget, I'm terrible with names for characters, but for someone like the guy in Top of the Lake, all that's required is for you to show up and to try and find the guy's soul, however twisted and perverse it might be. But also at the same time to be able to stand outside of it and look at it and see where it fits in to the bigger picture, because that's infinitesimally more important than just what you do.
Yeah.
It's a collaborative effort, especially with your fellow actors. It's what comes out of the interaction between actors that's what's important, not whether an individual's doing a sort of wonderful solo performance.
Well, Peter Mullen, finding the souls of the characters that you play is something that you've done time and time again for us on screen. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. Have a fantastic weekend at the Big Screen Symposium. Have you got a job to go to next, or are you waiting for the phone to ring?
Yeah, no, I'll go back to do a drama based on an Ian Banks novel, who sadly passed away last year. A great Scots novelist, international novelist, but originally from Scotland, called Spoonmouth. So I go back to do that. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Yeah, and we're all looking forward to it too. Peter Mullen, thanks very much for joining us here at Rancho Notorious.
Brilliant. Thanks a million, bro.
Peter Mullen, who's in Auckland for the Big Screen Symposium. We're recording this on a Friday morning. The Big Screen Symposium is on Saturday and Sunday in Auckland. I think that pre-registrations have closed for that now, but it may entirely be possible for you to turn up and register on the day for those events. Thoroughly recommend it if you've got an interest in screen storytelling or the screen industry.
Play in front of this door again. I'll chase you down with the street.
कल खाली डब्बा भेजने के लिए आपका शुक्रिया आज भेज रही हूँ पनीर मेरे हस्बैंड का फेवरेट इला
क्या लिखा पढ़
डियर इला द फूड वाज वेरी सॉल्टी टुडे
क्या ना थैंक यू ना नमस्ते ये ले डाल दे
हस्बैंड कल रात बहुत देर से आए, वो कुछ नहीं बोले।
Dear Ila, things are never as bad as they seem.
Irfan Khan and one of the great Indian actors, one of the great actors, let's not just call him an Indian actor, he's one of the great actors, and that's the new film, The Lunchbox. And Kaylee, you've seen that for us.
Yes, I have. It was in the New Zealand International Film Festival, so I saw it there. Very happy that it is coming out on general release, because it's such a lovely, gentle, nice little love story. That does leave a few quite moral questions hanging, but is one absolutely just heartwarming little tale about mistaken identity, I guess you could say. Not in any sort of taken Liam Neeson sort of high action way, but it is a case of mistaken lunch box delivery in Mumbai, which connects two people, one of them being Irfan Khan, who is about to retire, has been working a very long time doing accounts, some sort of bookkeeping, mistakenly gets the lunch of another man that was homemade by his lovely wife, and they start exchanging notes back and forward to each other.
Yeah, because the food's awesome, right? Like, this is the thing.
The food's
something
amazing.
There's something really special about this particular lunchbox. And the thing that amazed me about this is that, and the film does a really subtle, excellent job of telling you what this culture is like in Mumbai of lunchboxes, because it isn't just like he's the only one that gets a lunchbox. There's thousands of these things being distributed around one of the biggest cities in the world, and apparently this system is just incredibly efficient and it works. Like, wives and partners at home can cook a lunchbox, hand it off to somebody with not so much as a receipt, to somebody on a moped, who then carries dozens of these things to a central sort of exchange at a railway station. They go hither and yon, and then they somehow get delivered to the right person, and they come back empty to the right person again. I mean, it just seems inexplicable to me, but apparently it works, except in this case, thank goodness.
I think, don't they have like the home address put sewn into it somewhere, like a tag or something? I don't know.
Yeah. There must be, because there's no central registry, and there doesn't appear to be anybody even organizing it.
No. And if you are planning on seeing this film, which I do recommend, I highly suggest either eating Indian food before you go in or having a small snack and then going to an Indian restaurant immediately afterwards, because you'll be so hungry. I ate this just after I finished eating dinner, and I was like so hungry watching this film. It was just like, oh, the food, you know, and the smells, and it's just, oh, so good. And it was just so nice. It was a really light, like lighthearted love story that's just very easy to watch. I think I did a quick review of it earlier when the festival was on.
Yeah.
It's still just so lovely. So just, it's like a nice warm hug, you know.
Yeah, it's
just nice.
It's a very pleasant surprise. As I've said in different contexts elsewhere, and probably on this or the previous show that we did, Irfan Khan, if you don't know him, his name, you'll recognize him from, he played the grown-up Pi in Life of Pi. He was the cop investigating the Slumdog Millionaire, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire corruption case, ordering the torture. He is just an incredible face with these deep, soulful eyes, and he really does. I just think he should be in everything. You know, he's one of those actors like Jean Reno who, you know, everybody should just cast him because he will elevate their film.
Yeah.
So time is a little bit short today because we've got so much interview content. So we won't go into too much more detail about this one, but I think we should make at least a token effort to try and sum up with two words.
I think my two words for the lunchbox would be delightful feast.
Right. Well, mine are full belly.
Australian distributor Village Roadshow claims they are going to do something about long release windows between the US and Australia, and we presume New Zealand. Co-CEO Graham Burke told website Film Inc., "It makes total sense that when a movie opens and the web is ablaze with chatter, that we capitalize on the timeliness and worldwide excitement." Making movies available sooner should also help address the insidious piracy that is endangering film production, theaters, TV, and sports. Burke claims that all their major films will release on or around the date they emerge in the U.S., except that when that's not convenient for some reason.
This seemed to me. This seemed to me to be one of the more. I'm cynical about this because on this show and on the previous show that we did, we talked a lot about release windows and about why they occur for business reasons and, just little things like seasonal differences between hemispheres and school holidays and also for films that aren't massive blockbusters, the need to build word of mouth over a period of time around the world, you know, that day and date. We often find here in New Zealand that films that release, art house films that release here in New Zealand before Australia or before the US, they don't have international reviews in order to be able to go and sell them. So I'm pretty sure that they don't do the business that they perhaps could do if they had, we do our bit here on Rancho Notorious, but you know, we're not the New York Times, right? So it just seems to me that that this guy is saying, well, we're going to make all of our big films day and date. Well, that's true. I mean, you sort of do anyway now. Like the really, really big ones are all pretty much day and date internationally. I would rather a statement from Village Roadshow saying that they were actually going to release all of their films in New Zealand because, you know, New Zealand misses out on quite a lot of stuff that is on their slate. You remember the fuss that we had to make a couple of years ago over Cabin in the Woods to even get a festival screening of that. So, you know, maybe just committing to releasing the stuff that you've got anytime would be a benefit. The other thing I wanted to say about that is that how much piracy is there in the sports world anyway? Like, is that a big thing that you know, and sports, it all happens on a given day anyway, regardless. I mean, it's not as if there's a release window for the Melbourne Cup or something. I don't know. It just seemed to me that this was a statement that wasn't really going to change anything very much.
Yeah, sports is a funny one because to me, sports, all the money comes from like sponsorship, you know, and people buying tickets to the event, not so much from pay-per-view, but you know, that is still an income. So I guess that's an issue. But yeah, sports are pretty timely and pretty hard to avoid spoilers for. So
yeah, exactly.
And in other news, in cinematic television news, all about that people are quite a buzz on Twitter about this week, Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn have been confirmed as the two detectives in the second season of True Detective. Also a slight surprise that Fast and Furious' Justin Lin has been slated to direct the show. So I'm probably not going to watch it.
I don't know. I can't really speak with much authority on this one because I haven't seen the first True Detective yet. I'm waiting for the home video release rather than me trying to do what we've just been talking about and streaming and piracy and what have you. So I'm just waiting for it to land in my lap to find out what all the fuss was about. And I don't subscribe to Soho, which is the New Zealand's main channel for those HBO type shows. So yeah, so I don't really know what all the fuss is about. Well, apparently it is very, very good. I'm not a fan of Justin Lin. I think that his, you know, those Fast and Furious films are all right, but it does seem to be a bit of an interesting mix. Also, Vince Vaughn does have really quite good form as a serious actor, so let's not think that that's somehow demeaning the franchise in any way. I do think he's got it in him.
Yes,
and I'm more worried about Colin Farrell, to be honest.
Yeah, same. I do not like Colin Farrell. But you know, if it's the same writing team, you know, I think it might be worth watching. You know, out of curiosity, I guess we'll see. I haven't watched all of the first season, but it's pretty much been ruined for me. So, but I'm catching up on my other favorite shows. Now, speaking of television, I don't know if you have heard the rumors or know anything about these rumors that someone told me that it's might be become a bit easier to get Netflix in New Zealand. Is this true? Have you heard about this?
No. No, okay. My understanding is that there are now very strong rumors that Netflix will officially launch in Australia if it hasn't already. I'm pretty sure it's still they're still a bit like us in Australia and that they're going through back doors and what have you to get Netflix. But here in New Zealand, we now have QuickFlix, which has been around for quite a while, and Lightbox, which is Spark, the company that used to be known as Telecom. That's their streaming sort of on-demand service, and Sky are going to be launching their one before the end of the year as well. So there's going to be a few options around for that sort of method of watching content. But I haven't heard anything about Netflix launching here. I think this market here is way too small. They're still pushing out through Europe, you know, where the real money is.
I mean, it's great to have other companies doing similar things, but it is really all about the content. So I guess we'll just have to see what these other providers have.
Indeed. All right. Fantastic Fest has just finished in Austin, Texas, the 5-day festival and party. They're one of the most unique and most unique. God, who writes this stuff? One of the more unique. God, it's even worse. Anyway, a fantastic festival called Fantastic Fest. Jonathan King, the New Zealand writer and director, best known for Black Sheep and Under the Mountain, his new film Reality, which world premiered at the New Zealand International Film Festival, was invited to screen at Fantastic Fest. So off he went to witness the proceedings. When I spoke to him yesterday, he is in LA, actually, on his way back home after in sort of recovery mode after Fantastic Fest. But I talked to him about
Jonathan King,
his
welcome
experience.
To Rancho Notorious.
Thank you. It's very nice to be with you.
Jonathan, you're talking to us at the moment from Los Angeles, the city of the angels. And so tell me, what are you doing there at the moment?
I'm mostly shopping from the very extensive list that my children have given me as to what they want from America. But other than that, I am en route back from Austin, Texas, where I've been to Fantastic Fest. My new film, Reality.
Yeah, Fantastic Fest is one of the most extraordinary festivals in the film world. Was that your first trip to that event?
No, it's my second, actually. I was there with Under the Mountain about, I guess, 4 or 5 years ago. And, they very kindly had me back. I think one feature of the festival is that they are very generous and loyal to people they've had before. So Tim League, who runs the festival and runs the Alamo Draft House, was a huge fan of Under the Mountain and kind of invited that. And he dug Reality as well, so invited us along to that. So it's been amazing, really.
Reality is your new feature film, and a film that we were wanting to talk about on the show during the New Zealand International Film Festival, but timing didn't really allow for it. So perhaps this is an opportunity for you to explain to our listeners what Reality is. Explain the concept of reality to us, please.
Reality, the film, is a slightly sci-fi art house, new wave thriller ish about an up and coming young media executive who stumbles onto a plot involving a drug called Reality, which is designed to influence consumer opinions on things, but in fact may have a stronger influence on even people's perception of reality itself.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the making of Reality. It's consumed quite a lot of your life over the last few years, yeah?
Well, it sort of has. I mean, it was made for a very modest budget. The screenplay was written by Chad Taylor, who was an old friend, and we'd been wanting to work together for a long time. And we had the screenplay. He had the screenplay, and we said, you know what? Let's just make this. So we made it essentially self-financed. I've sort of spent the last year and a half, or we've spent the last year and a half making it. which in fact is as long as you usually spend concentrating, shorter time than you usually spend concentrating on getting a film made. The difference is that there's been more of that time has been production itself, rather than chasing money, trying to stitch the deal together, and then making the film in a very short period of time. Just kind of chipping away at the film, sort of shooting over last year and a little bit at the beginning of this year, and then some post-production, and really it was only finished a couple of weeks before the New Zealand Film Festival.
And shot here in Wellington?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, all shot in Wellington, in and around the city, which has been great. My first film, Black Sheep, was made in Wellington, and the second was made in Auckland, for obvious reasons, but... it was a lot of fun to make a very Wellington film, really. And there are Wellington, it's not Wellington, or it's not New Zealand in the film, but nor is it obviously Wellington. But there are some key kind of found locations, really, which are very distinctive if you know what they are. But I'm really pleased to have had those in the film and be making a film based at home, yeah.
Right. The film screened at the New Zealand International Film Festival here in July, and now obviously Fantastic Fest as well. What else is on the agenda for it? Are people who missed it first time around going to get a chance to see it here locally, or perhaps we have quite a few Australian listeners who might be interested as well?
Yeah, well, look, we absolutely want people to see the film, and that was a big reason for just, I guess, going here and making it, to make sure it was seen. But we are looking at, we've kind of got our eye on what kind of worldwide distribution we can set up, first of all. And since the film's been in Fantastic Fest, there's been a lot of interest on that score. So we're kind of pursuing those opportunities now, pursuing other international film festivals as much as we can. But talking to a few people about local distribution. But whatever happens, yeah, before long, we absolutely want people to see it. So, it's a film of, I guess, it's not going to be for everyone, but we do think the people who want to see it are really enjoying it. So, it will never have a hugely wide release, I think, but definitely people who are interested enough to find it will absolutely get the chance.
Great. Let's talk a little bit about your Fantastic Fest experience this time around. This is it's not a festival that I've been to before, but it seems to be one that where its impact is growing year on year. Perhaps a little bit like Comic-Con hasn't taken off to quite the same degree, but it's certainly its influence on movie culture and fandom seems to be growing year on year.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's the people who, Tim League, who runs it, Austin is a town that loves movies and loves supporting movies and discovering movies, and Tim is the biggest kind of champion and cheerleader of all of that. So the Draft House chain are really fantastic about showing great movies, and they, for some time now, they've been doing kind of cool stunts or innovative things like playing Jaws at Martha's Vineyard where it was shot, or Close Encounters out at the Devil's Rock, is it called, where that was filmed. But they're really passionate about movies and the crowds that come to it. So you basically have to buy a badge which gets you into the whole festival, or then the kind of last second half badges and stuff. But it's a kind of total commitment experience, really. You don't just pick and choose a few films. You buy in, and there's a huge demand for the badges, and then everyone who's there is just hungry to devour every single thing that they can that's on. So there's, you basically make a choice, make choices through the day of four, five, or six films. There's always three or four things playing at once, so you can't even see everything if you want to. But they're really passionate and film smart audiences. So it is a genre film festival, but that's a pretty broad envelope even. So there are smart horror films and trashy horror films and a lot of amazing Scandinavian films, particularly this year, including kind of crime films and horror films and even dramas with a bit of a skew to them. So it's a great place to see movies. And then you get, I guess, influential film writers coming there from other parts of the States, particularly, and from the UK and things. And they've got such a good eye for films. You know, they discover things and I guess launch them to the States particularly, but to the world when people might not otherwise hear of them. So it's a real it's a real thrill to be part of that.
There's a whole lot of...
But it's a great one. Yeah, so just cover films too as a punter.
There's a whole lot of extraneous events going on that I wonder from a distance seem to maybe it's just a whole part of the party atmosphere and what have you, but it seems to sort of make the festival a very different one to a kind of serious cinephile one. You know, you've got the boxing and the nerd rap and various other things. It seems like it's not just screenings but a kind of 5-day party.
Yeah, well, it's, maybe not even just partying, but evidence of how incredibly seriously and passionately everybody there takes that kind of thing. So the boxing was part of a debate. Each year there's a debate of which a component is standing, I'm speaking, and then the other component is punching each other. And so you get people... who are, you know, that passionate about their point of view or about whatever's being debated or about and about just being there, that they'll literally come to blows about it. So last year, Christchurch's own Andrew Todd, who's closely involved with 48 Hour Films and things down there, he boxed an actor, and then this year Todd Brown from Twitch Film in Canada and also XYZ Films was debating whether or not BitTorrent was the savior of films or the greatest fit for it, and then he got in the ring to defend his point of view. So it's I guess just an indication of passion and fun, a sense of passion and fun, really. And so it's a wider about having a great time and about just living it 24 hours a day for, I mean, the most, it doesn't quite last a week, but 4 or 5 days of very intense stuff.
Sure. We haven't even talked about films. Before I let you go and get back to Rodeo Drive or wherever it is that you're about to go shopping, what were a couple of your picks of the films that you saw at Fantastic Fest this year?
Well, I've seen more films in the last 5-6 days than I have in the previous year, I must say, but there were a couple of things that I'd missed at the local star festivals, like It Follows and The Babadook and Force Majeure, which I really loved. And I saw a terrific Scandinavian film called In Order of Disappearance with Stellan Skarsgård, which was really brilliant. When Animals Dream, I think, was in our festivals as well, which I'd miss.
Well, what are we learning here? We're learning that the New Zealand International Film Festival is ahead of many curves.
Well, that's absolutely true, yeah. I mean, because of the timing of our festival, ours comes so quickly after Cannes, I guess, and a lot of films are kind of holding back to that. We're after Cannes and before
Toronto
for example. Feel rest assured that we are absolutely getting the best things in New Zealand. But look, it's a chance for those films and films like mine too. And I'm Housebound plays there as well. And it's a chance for, I guess, focus for that kind of film to be on our films and those kinds of films, which is, you know, it's exposure you literally can't buy, really.
Hello, Conchita. I have something. I have something to say.
What happened?
I'm not coming home.
You have a call waiting.
This is Ivan Locke.
We have a situation here.
You're the man in charge of the entire operation, but you've decided you ain't going to be there.
I'm not going to turn back.
Hey, Dad, are you coming back?
Sean, something's happened. I need you to hold it together for me. It'll be a long night.
We are facing $100 million worth of losses.
Listen, I will take care of it. I'm trying to do the right thing.
Tom Hardy with what may or may not be his actual accent. I don't know if he is Welsh, to be honest. But it occurs to me that I don't actually know what his accent is, his real one. That's a sign of a good actor, isn't it? When you don't really know what they sound like in real life. Anyway, so there he is. He's alone in a car on a motorway on a quest, taking lots of phone calls and trying to hold his family together, his job together, his life together, even though outside of the car everything seems to be falling apart. This is a cracker, isn't it?
It is. So I'm just looking up Tom. Oh, no, he's English. He's English.
Well, he's bloody good. It's a bloody good accent, that one. It sounded to me, listening to it, that it was almost as if Anthony Hopkins had been given the Daniel Day-Lewis part in There Will Be Blood. And, you know, there's this lovely calming, you know, he's doing his level best to keep everybody calm, even though the shit is going down everywhere around him. It's beautiful to listen to, and Welsh accents are great to listen to anyway. I mean, they're just fantastic. It's like Irish. Anyway, that's just me. This is a film that's written and directed by Stephen Knight, who has only just started directing his own screenplays, but his earlier screenplays, including Dirty Pretty Things, was made by Stephen Frears, Eastern Promises by David Cronenberg, and he in the UK, he's probably best known as the guy who invented Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and here he is. I think he's doing some really, really interesting work. This is a film that could easily have just been, I guess, an art exercise or an acting exercise, and could easily be kind of dismissible, but it's not that at all. I think it's essential.
Mm. Yeah, and this is one of those films, and I know we say this often, but the less you know about what is happening, the better, because I mistakenly read a synopsis that had a little bit too much information in it, which spoiled a bit of the surprise. Yeah, it was really enjoyable, very watchable. I mean, Tom Hardy is a super handsome dude, so he's very watchable in basically everything. I wouldn't say it keeps you on the edge of your seat, but for a guy sitting in a car for 90 minutes, it locks in your attention.
Yeah, and it's pretty much in real time as well, isn't it? You know, it's a 90-minute car journey, and we never really have an opportunity to sort of step away. And I mean, the tension just gets built up minute by minute. I was watching this and thinking how, you know, so many films are basically have male protagonists. You know, it's 85% or something of films have male protagonists, some tragic number. But very few films are actually genuinely about what male experience is like, you know? And this seemed to me to be a film that was about what being a man is, what being a father is, what being a worker is, a breadwinner is, and what being a son is as well. And I really respected the script and the performances for that, because, you know, so often in movies, men are the protagonists of films, but you don't really learn anything about what male experience is, you know. And this one, I think, did you feel that you learnt a little bit about male psychology from it?
No, not really.
I sympathized, empathized, and was, you know, I totally got it. The tension between a work life and a home life, and I've been in those situations where you're on the phone home to say I'm on my way, and then something happens at work and you can't leave, and you just think, who needs me more in this situation? How do I keep all of these people, all of these elements happy? How do I keep all of these plates spinning?
Yeah, I appreciated the performance in the script, because he was just honestly trying to do the right thing and be a good person. And you, as the film moves along, you know, you sort of learn why he's making these decisions, and sort of what drives him to be the person he wants to be. So it was a fairly well fleshed out character as the film goes along. So yeah, it was a very interesting exercise. I always enjoy films that are really about actors, you know, acting. And I think this definitely checked those boxes for me. So yeah, very, very enjoyable.
And it is a unique concept, and it does mean that anybody else from now until forever who wants to make a film about one character in a car is going to be forever compared with this. And you know, we complain often out here in cinephile land about how all these films always look the same and we've seen it all before. Well, here's one we haven't seen before, and it's really, really worthwhile. Mm-hmm. Two words.
My two words are hearty performance.
Cool, nice work. My two words are high road. And that is our show for this week. Next week at Rancho Notorious, we have a special guest live at the ranch. It's going to be Liam McGurran from flix.co.nz.
He's live in studio and I'll miss it.
Oh. Well, I'm sure, you know, there will be other opportunities. But you will be missed at dinner afterwards, I'm sure. That's going to be fun. It'll be really cool to actually go back to recording in the evening as opposed to dawn. But you are going to join us for that. Yeah. You'll still be in Vancouver, we're going to be talking about David Fincher's Gone Girl next week, Maze Runner, which you've got a chance to see, I think, and we'll try and squeeze in Box Trolls maybe, and Denzel Washington in a remake of a English TV series called The Equalizer. Yeah, if you've enjoyed this episode, you can subscribe to us at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us via email, or you can make a comment.
Yes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, where we'll be tweeting incessantly about things we think are interesting. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too. Username is Rancho Notorious, all one word.
The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Catto, Random Films, Claire Quiray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music is Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly by Los Plantronics. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to play you out with some more music. Here's our guest from earlier on, Peter Mullen, from the soundtrack of the film Sunshine on Leith. This is his version of Gene by The Proclaimers. Special thanks to my partner Karen, who makes sure that everyone who visits us here at Rancho Notorious is well-fed and looked after. Thanks to our guests, Peter Mullen and Jonathan King. Thanks to Kaylee in Canada. Thanks to you all for listening. And that's good morning from me, Dan Slevin.
And good afternoon from me.
Okay, I want to thank everybody for coming here today. I know some of you have travelled far, and we really appreciate the effort you've made to get here.
I've never been lucky with girls, I confess. Don't know who to blame for my lack of success. Because even the ones at the back of your bus, there's always a risk of slapping the puss. But
Gene, oh Gene, you let me get lucky with you. Gene, ah, Gene, you let me get lucky with you. First time I met her, it did cross my mind. Next time I saw her, I hadn't the time. Third time I saw her, I thought that I should. Fourth time I met her, I knew that I would. Cause Gene, ah, Gene, you let me get lucky with you. Is Gene, ah Gene, you let me get lucky with you. I love her, I love her, I love her, love her, I love her.